powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Hour number two of Tom, Jake, and Stacy. Now, we've gone wall-to-wall Seahawks here the whole time, haven't we, so far?
Yeah, pretty much.
Talked a little bit of that Astros stuff with Mike Sauk there. You know, we're going to talk to Danny O'Neill coming up at 2, and we'll hit on a little bit of Seahawks with him, as we always do, but he and Paul Gallant are actually down at Mariners spring training right now, if you've been listening in the morning. So we'll get a little flavor for what's going on there. And by the way, this hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacy brought to you by Queen Charlotte Lodge. Now, this is a topic we're about to get to here that we sort of touched on yesterday, but we're not entirely sure if the Seahawks have learned their lesson from last season. And this, of course, is the issue of the nickel corner. Everybody, when I feel like when we get on social media, we talk to you guys, the fans. One of the major complaints last year was that they were in their base 4-3 the whole way, even in passing downs, which is about, what, 70% of the time coming at them. And everybody's wondering why. And we heard the quote from John Schneider yesterday addressing this. And I guess we're still left a little bit uncertain as to how they're going to handle this.
It is interesting to sit here at this point in time and to have the base defense being talked about and have it being addressed. And I think what Pete Carroll was alluding to was the fact that, hey, they were good versus three wide receivers. That's what their statistics are telling them. But they really struggled against, you know, 12 personnel, 21 personnel, two running back, two tight end sets. And that's very peculiar because that's the reason why you run base personnel, is because you want to match your three linebackers on the field with their heavier formations. So it's interesting that that's the situation that ends up coming about. But when I look at things, I also don't understand where they're coming from on this. How good were they? How much better were their numbers in this scenario? Because your defense was 27th in the league. So how good was it really to justify and sit there and say, well, it was, you know, it was good versus this, and it was actually better in our other situations, when you waited as long as you did to play a young, talented rookie in Ugo Amadi at that nickel cornerback spot, who actually played pretty well. And I didn't see any glaring holes that Ugo Amadi presented or put them in a compromising position when teams were running the football on them or anything like that. So it's a situation that I can't really put my finger on, that I'm very confused as to why that continues to be a battle, because John Schneider talked about it and said, you know what, we need to look at that nickel cornerback spot as a position that is a starting position.
Yeah, you know, Ugo did a nice job when he got out there. We didn't play a ton of nickel last year. So, you got to look at the nickel position like a starter, right? And, you know, Detroit got Coleman, gave him a nice contract. He did a great job for them again. But we need to keep preparing along the way. That's a starting position is basically what I'm saying, right? You're on the field, like, usually 70-some percent of the time.
Jake, it's for that reason that I love this topic, because it makes Jake so mad. And he won't just admit that.
It doesn't make me that.
It does make him mad. Jake, you literally started this. You started by saying, I think it's interesting, which is the equivalent of saying, I just think it's funny how immediately going in on whatever John Schneider says. But it's true. I mean, Jake, each time they've mentioned Ugo Amadi, it started with him calling for Ugo Amadi to play, calling to see more nickel. And you were fine with base defense, but Seattle was doing it in kind of an opposite way of other teams. They were sticking with their base defense well over half the time, whereas other teams are in a nickel defense like 70% of the time. Jake was saying, I'd like to see more Ugo Amadi. I'd like to see more Ugo Amadi. You don't see him out there. Finally, Pete Carroll pits him out there, says, yeah, we probably pit him out there a little too late. Jake, you could see steam coming out of his ears when that quote first came out. He's rubbing his temples now.
When was that?
That was, what, late last season?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what game that was in particular. It was literally, I think, maybe the second to last game of the season where they started to implement Ugo Amadi. And then, obviously, the Philadelphia game is really where he played really well.
The regular season game, or the playoff game?
Mm-hmm. Where they really started playing him more, and he really rose to the occasion. And that's maybe where the quote came from, is that week in particular. And it is. It is frustrating to sit there and look at this situation, and it's not just from the standpoint of, you know, it became an echo chamber at some point in this town. Well, base defense, nickel defense, this and that. It's just about playing, matching, and making your defense as malleable as possible, right? We talk about that offense adjusting, right, and being willing to be adaptable, right, during a game. It's the same thing on defense. When you start to be stubborn about your 4-3 defense because that's what you think is best for your team.
Are you hearing the anger?
And not having Ugo Amadi out on nickel. I'm not mad.
He's getting a little fired up right now, having
that nickel defense and that nickel presence with Ugo Amadi, that extra playmaker out on the field, and add that team speed. At some point in time, it became frustrating to watch that and to not understand why they were giving up on something that was so integral to their philosophy for so many years. And we've seen them. We've had this impassioned, you know, feeling before, Tom, about Marquise Blair, right? It made no sense why they didn't keep him on the field, because he was a talented young rookie, but for whatever reason, they didn't trust him. It's the same thing with Ugo Amadi, and now they look back, and I guess I wish that they would come out and just say, you know what? Michael Kendricks isn't going to be a part of this team to start out. And now we're going to go into this next phase of embracing nickel defense. Ugo Amadi is our starter for now. There's going to be competition, but this is the direction that we're going to go. We're going to get back to Seahawk football. I guess that's what I'm trying to express.
I want to see them
get back to that, because they don't have the talent to be able to run base defense. It doesn't make any sense for them to run base defense at this point.
Why not go against the grain?
I love Cody Barton, but he's not your starting, three down linebacker every single game. I think he works great in tandem with KJ Wright, and they can keep each other healthy, and you can add team speed, but you got to have playmakers out on the field. When you talk about a secondary that's struggling, part of that is having a very good nickel corner that you can rely on, trust on, to help make plays for you, to help disguise your defense a little bit better.
But they trust Ugo Amadi.
They don't. They don't. Clearly, they showed that they didn't trust Ugo
Amadi.
Pete Carroll said it's his job to lose now, Jake. I don't necessarily buy that, because there was a sound of Pete Carroll talking about Ugo Amadi and saying that there were other guys that they had their eye on for competition. And if that's the case, I'm fine. I'm all good with competition. That's part of the philosophy of Pete Carroll. But from what we saw from Ugo Amadi at the end of the year last year, I think he's a young, talented playmaker that they need to try and invest in and try and trust and believe, just like with Marquise Blair.
Jake, you could theoretically host an entire show by yourself
on the nickel corner.
Just on this topic.
That's what I'm saying.
And probably take calls.
Jake doesn't get bothered by so many things that bother normal people. And then you'll start talking about like a nickel corner and he's enraged.
I saw a little fist pounding on the...
He did. He started doing the whole, like, I think that they need to.
But, you know, then again, you are a pretty mild-mannered person. I mean, is that as angry as you get, or do you get angrier?
I guess I can get angry. I don't mean to try and,
like, during
get
the
angry,
season
but...
when you were watching this stuff go on, when you were at your house in front of none of us, were you like pounding the coffee table?
Yeah, and there was some
throwing pillows.
Text messages with Brock Heward I don't think any of us are. Either one of us are proud of.
Really?
We just like to keep him in the dark. Pete Carroll saying, I wish we would have put him in sooner. Jake stood up out of his chair.
I can't help you with that. I'm sorry.
Like with nickel corner and what they were able to do traditionally, where they had, you know, Jeremy Lane, they had Deshaun Shedd, you give me the nickel corner that they had before
Justin
that.
Justin Coleman
as well, Walter Thurman. Those guys, what they allowed you to do was they allowed you to have some creativity in your defense. You didn't know whether they were going to be playing man coverage, cover three, if the nickel was going to be blitzing off the edge. They did a really good job of presenting the same picture over and over and making it different, you know, every single time with that nickel cornerback spot. with a linebacker who's out in space, out in coverage like that, like Michael Kendricks was, as great of an athlete as he is, he was not as good as disguising those coverages and those situations. It's just hard to when you're not familiar with it. It's not a place that you typically go. So I just would love to see them get back to some of that because I think it adds a level of intricacy to their defense. It's not complex, but it just makes the quarterback think just a second longer.
Do you think John Schneider was happy with how much they played base defense?
Say that one more time.
Do you think John Schneider was happy with how much they played base defense?
When he comes out and says something like that, I think it's very interesting. When he comes out and basically says, you know, hey, this nickel guy, you know, with how much defense we play, and it's interesting to hear the percentages that he threw out. Like, you know, he threw out 60-70% of the time. You know, they would typically want to see nickel defense out on the field. I think that's a big part of it. And that, to me, really raises my ears when I hear something like that come from Josh.
When they
Schneider.
Draft Ugo Amadi, are they thinking this guy is going to be for the purpose of a nickel corner? Or are they saying we're going to use him however?
Well, I think that they use it in terms of the purpose of it. Yeah, for sure.
They didn't just say, okay, we're going to turn him into a regular cornerback.
No, they knew that he had the flexibility to play either safety or nickel.
Okay, because to answer Stacy's question, if I'm John Schneider and I'm drafting Ugo Amadi and I say, all right, that guy can work in nickel, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden he doesn't get used for however many weeks,
I think that's
that
more,
might be a little frustrating.
I think that's more of what it is. A front yes. office always wants coaches to use players earlier, and coaches always want to be able to trust players. Can you explain why, for fans that are like, okay, I know what a nickel corner is, why does it make you so upset? Like, why? What's the... In a way for fans to understand,
It's just adjustments is really what it comes down to.
And it can prevent big yardage plays from I mean, think about all the plays, deep plays, right? Explosive plays that you're giving up because you're not in that formation.
It's part of that, and it's part of also the fact that you're doing something completely different and it isn't necessarily working in your favor. It's great to have Michael Kendricks, KJ Wright, and Bobby Wagner on the field, and that was great to see those guys in lockstep, but at times it wasn't as effective as they were hoping it to be. So there was not a recognition of that at times, and now you try to adapt and you try to adjust. It doesn't mean you don't ever put them on the field together. It just means that you're not so stubborn to say, we're going to play this 70% of the time at all times. Because I think that hurt them later down the stretch when you have Ugo Amadi in situations where he's having to play one-on-one coverage versus Devontae Adams, and he just basically is a player that's only played 4 games during the season.
Did we help you at all to vent that?
Yeah.
Do you feel better?
Yeah, I do feel better.
We're here for you.
You don't think you're going to go on another tirade about this soon?
Well, I'm not
no,
positive
he absolutely
about that.
Will.
I'm not positive, but
I mean, you didn't reach the levels of my anti-Gonzaga.
No, ranting. I didn't.
It wasn't the most fired up.
That's a very hard thing to reach, Tom. It's a very difficult thing to reach.
All right, we're in 4-down territory.
This is 4-down territory
with Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
You live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
Is it bad news that the Chiefs are planning to franchise tag D lineman Chris Jones?
Well, if you're the Seahawks and a Seahawks fan, I wouldn't say it's necessarily bad news. What it does is it clears things up. It clears up the market. And what it can do is it can put one less suitor on the table for Clowney. I don't think the Chiefs were ever in a position where they could go after Clowney. But as you kind of see where the dust settles and these franchise tags start to come about on players, it really kind of narrows the vision of teams and also places that Clowney could end up signing. So I think it ends up working in your favor. But what you hope, though, is that all of the talented players, like we talked about Dante Fowler Jr., does he end up getting tagged by the Rams? Yannick Ngakoue, does he end up getting tagged by the Jacksonville Jaguars? So the replacements that you're hoping for potentially, if Clowney doesn't end up signing with you, you hope that top tier doesn't end up just getting franchise tagged. And really, you're working with a mid to bottom tier replacements. I think that's the fear. But ultimately, it's going to be exciting for us to go through this because we've got our second phase of our offseason promo coming up in terms of our free agent profiles. Now we're looking at not Seahawk players that we're trying to re-sign. We're looking at players that we're identifying as potential candidates that the Seahawks should be targeting out in the free agent market starting on Monday next week.
Second down. You're killing our ratings. Absolutely manhandling our ratings.
Way more people. This is going to go viral. They're going to be like, amazing voice from person on radio.
Stacey?
Yeah?
Who are Elliot Wolf and Alonzo Highsmith?
So the two of them and obviously Seahawks GM John Schneider all have ties to the Packers front office. So GM John Schneider is bringing in these two to be kind of consultants during the Seahawks draft process. They haven't worked together yet. They were just recently hired, like, what, a couple days ago to come in and help. So they're going to meet with the team, John Schneider told John Clayton, in about 3 weeks, and they'll be helping with the draft process. And then it sounds like they're going to be helping with a separate project. But quick background. So Elliot Wolf actually has an extended history with John Schneider. John Schneider obviously worked under Elliot's father, Ron Wolf, who was GM of the Packers through most of the 90s. Elliot is a former assistant GM from Cleveland, so he was kind of a GM candidate. But they... in Cleveland, used someone else when he could have had that shot. So
what does
obviously
that say
didn't
about
want to stay.
Him?
I mean, he's a young guy. He's like in his mid to late 30s. It could just be they had someone else they liked more, and they liked him in the assistant GM role, and maybe they wanted him to stay. But he obviously already has ties with John Schneider, so maybe he was far more interested in coming in as a consultant there.
Maybe it means that they're fools for not giving him the job.
Maybe. Alonzo Highsmith was also with the Browns. He was VP player personnel, but he was originally with the Packers front office in 2012. John Schneider was not there at the time, obviously, but all of them have roots to that organization and that front office.
Third down. Of all the Seahawks' recently reported prospect visits, who intrigues you the most? Do you want me to read through these? Because these are some tough names.
Yeah, there are some tough names here,
to.
Tom.
I can try.
You know what? I don't.
No,
want
I do.
You.
I would like
I'm
you
not
going to
put you on the spot.
Why don't you just do three?
All right, wide receiver Jalen Reagor.
Okay,
is that it?
Sounds like a Targaryen.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I will.
Oh, you don't know. Okay.
I will be firmed up on this probably by the weekend.
All right, there's a defensive end.
There you go.
Whew.
Yep.
Yetur Gross-Matos.
Sure. Yep. Sounds good to me. That's how it looks like.
Julian Okwara. That's a good. And then Bradley Anae.
That's right. Bradley Anae.
Spelled A-N-A-E.
Yes. I would say the guys that the Seahawks have been known to visit so far, a couple names really stand out. To me, the first two names that really pop are Ross Blacklock, defensive tackle from TCU, and Yetur Gross-Matos. Now, I don't know exactly how the pronunciation is. I'm going to try and get that down.
All right.
Defensive end from Penn State. Those two guys, to me, are players that address your immediate need on the defensive line. Ross Blacklock is a very intriguing defensive tackle prospect that actually is one of the more talented players in this draft. Gross-Matos from Penn State, he is a twitchy pass rusher who has that top tier type of ability. So when you talk about Schneider talking about ledges and ledges in terms of talent and how big those drop offs are, the defensive end out of Penn State, he is a part of that first tier. It goes Chase Young far and above everybody else, AJ Espinoza from Iowa, and then this defensive end from Penn State. Those are really your top tier guys at that defensive end position. And then there's another ledge there. So another name that really stands out to me is Jalen Reagor from TCU. He is a speedy wide receiver, a guy who's going to run in the sub 4.2s, 4.3s. He is a punt returner. He's an explosive player and a guy that I think you know, really kind of resembles him is Mecole Hardman for the Kansas City Chiefs. He came out of Georgia last year. I think the Seahawks were very intrigued by him last time around, and I think that Jalen Reagor is a guy that could fit that mold or that type of player that they were once looking for in 2019.
Every time you say twitchy for a D-end, I think about a guy who's...
Do you feel like twitching?
Well, no. I feel like I'm watching a guy who's lined up and who's on the verge of jumping offside. He's like...
Kind of.
And then he just, you know, because he can't help himself.
It's kind of like how Clowney always has the neutral zone infractions, but he's also so disruptive that you're like, oh, I'll take a couple.
Right.
Yeah, we'll take a couple of those.
That's what Michael Bennett was.
Well,
you know,
Michael Bennett lined up offside. There's a difference.
That's true.
Like his hand was over the line of scrimmage when he was laying there. Like, twitchy is like, I gotta go.
Yeah, he got away from it. He got away with it for so long.
He did. Fourth down. Saw a tweet. Somebody wanted Bruce Irvin. They were actually calling upon Bruce Irvin to make a return to the West Coast. He endorsed it. He put up an emoji that I didn't quite understand.
I saw it as the...
It was like a talking emoji?
Like an endorsing emoji. You're like, yeah, talk that talk. You know what I mean?
Oh, talk that talk.
Yeah. Like, it's the emoji that someone, their mouth is open and they're clearly shouting.
It looks like they're spitting.
No, I think shouting. It's like spitting. A sound. No, Tom.
Okay.
Why don't you let me handle the emoji translations?
You're right. Now, he's a little older, but he's been very productive since leaving Seattle. How would he fit here now?
Well, Bruce Irvin, when he first signed on with Seattle... it was interesting because he played a dual role. He was mostly there to be an edge rusher, but they put him at Sam linebacker, and he did an incredible job, made a transition very easily, played that Sam linebacker position, was great in coverage, understood rules and responsibilities. He was quick. He was fast, could stay with tight ends and running backs and slot receivers. It was very impressive. Actually, and it could still get after the quarterback. At this stage in his career, I don't think that they're going to put him at that Sam linebacker position and then translate him to defensive end in pass rushing situations. They would be bringing on Bruce Irvin to strictly be a defensive end. That would be my assumption at this point in stage in his career. I think it would be a very good move for the Seahawks. Although he is a veteran player, he is a guy who can still be very productive, still get after the quarterback, and also brings a presence and an attitude that I think would be very welcomed on this defense that really didn't have any chippiness whatsoever to this group last year.
Since leaving Seattle, he, let's see, 2016 with Oakland, 7 sacks. 2017 with Oakland, 8 sacks. 2018, he was with both the Falcons and the Raiders, 6.5. And then last year with Carolina, 8.5. That is a very productive career for a linebacker.
And very worth having here. I think with his presence, just not only the production, the consistency in which he produces, but also, like I said, with his attitude, his chippiness. I think that that's something that could be very much a welcomed addition to this defense, and that's something that we talked about at length last year, that this defense very much lacked that type of attitude and presence out on the field.
And that production as far as sack totals. Like, he would have led all Seahawks by sacks by 4.
Oh, yeah, by a mile.
Yeah.
I mean, 6 forced fumbles back in 2016. Now, here's the thing that I remember about him when he was here. Just as far as sack totals go, just that. And maybe just pressuring the passer, I'll say. He seemed to disappear from games for long periods of time. And even, like, stretches, like, from week to week. And then all of a sudden, he would be on fire for a week or even for a game. Can't remember which was it the Fail Mary game? No, that was Chris Clements who had like a huge game. There was one game, maybe it was against Carolina, where Bruce Irvin had like a bunch of sacks in one game and then kind of went away for a while. I don't know that that's how his career has gone since then necessarily, but I agree with what you're saying. I mean, if he came back, you use him a little bit differently now. But was certainly a fun guy while he was here.
There's no doubt about that.
A fun guy.
Like a mushroom.
Yeah.
Why do they call the mushroom the highlight of the party? Because he's a fun guy.
We're back in a second. 710 ESPN.
It's time for the halftime show.
The half is not over. There's 3 seconds on the clock.
Revisiting the biggest stories of today at the midpoint of the show.
The halftime show. It's not easy.
Now, here's Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
I'm picturing John Schneider and Pete Carroll and a handful of others in John Schneider's office on the day that Jadeveon Clowney gets signed by somebody else. And then Schneider looks around the room and he says, "Guys, we've got nothing because now we need to build this whole thing from scratch and we can't do that in 1 year."
Oh, I think they've definitely got their eyes on some guys in the draft they probably think they could get.
Yeah, but okay, first year.
They have to have it. These people are so insanely prepared that there is a scenario in their mind in which they do not get Clowney and they have a plan.
But is that a Super Bowl plan?
Are they?
It's got to be. That's the only plan you can make.
Yeah, but
their plan has to be a Super Bowl plan. There's no way as a GM, head coach combo in the NFL when you could be fired any year because organizations never have patience. There's no way that you're going to tell them like, "Hey, how about a step back year?"
Why not?
Because you can't do that. No, not in football.
They're in their window now. As Stacey pointed out, I do believe that they have their contingency plans, but as that scenario that you just said, Tom, I think that they will be disappointed. That they will be like a 10-second mourning period of losing Clowney, and then they got to go to work and figure out the next thing. Because Clowney is a guy that they need to get back. He's a player that is a known commodity to this organization. They know what they can get out of him. They know the disruption that he presents to opposing defenses, and you can build around that and be comfortable with what you're doing moving forward. You lose out on Clowney, now you're dipping into the free agent market not knowing what you're going to get and hoping that it can work and translate onto the field for you, but you have to put even more pieces on that defensive line and try and figure this whole thing out. So it's not an ideal situation if you're the Seahawks.
You don't really know what you're going to get out of Clowney either, so I mean, what's the difference? It's all just a big gamble.
It is a big gamble.
The question is, do you want to spend all that money?
It's a more calculated risk
on
for the Seahawks.
Guy, right, it is.
With Clowney. It's a more calculated risk. They feel more comfortable with it. But I do think that all is not lost. If you lose out on Clowney, there's still some very good options. The thing is as we pointed out in Four Down Territory earlier, you can go onto our podcast page and download or subscribe to our podcast to check it out if you missed it. But it's something that you hope that all of the top-tier pass rushers that we think are going to be available on the open market don't get franchise tagged. Because if they get franchise tagged, now your market has shrunk and you're not able to pick from the top tier as much as you would have liked.
By the way, you can listen to our show via the 710 Sports app powered by Dubin Law Group. Next. When we had Salk in here before, this is something we haven't really gotten a chance to expand on. I was asking him about the Astros, who have been hit by a lot of pitches lately. My question to him was, you know, is there going to come a point very soon where this hitting Astros just kind of gets old? And he thought the answer was yes, I agreed. I mean, what is it? Does every pitcher in the league need a chance to throw at these guys? Or is the point being made?
That's where I don't blame Rob Manfred from coming out and saying, hey, there's going to be punishment if you go after these guys. Because I do think that every pitcher feels like they need to be macho in that situation and make a statement. Like, I just genuinely do. Like, if you're going to leave it up to those guys and let baseball handle baseball in this case, normally I'm all for it. It's part of the game. This is how it goes. Let them manage it. But this is something where it can get out of hand pretty quickly. And so I think every team's going to take their shot, though. I don't think you can prevent it. I think every team is going to take their shot. There's not, you know, hey, everybody across Major League Baseball, this pitcher and this pitcher in Series 1 and 2, they're going to get their shots, and then we're
right,
going to call
they
it
don't
good.
Have, they don't have a chart up in the
well,
clubhouse
and there are some guys
saying
that are,
who's already hit it.
Exactly. Right. And there, can you imagine? And there are some guys that are going to want a shot that might not get a chance to face them until late in the season. They don't play the Dodgers in the regular season. But, I mean, if that was something where they played the Dodgers in, like, I don't know, early September or something, I don't think you could really fault them for taking a shot.
Probably not.
And here's the other issue is if you're Rob Manfred and you're mad at the league for doing this, well, guess what? The players in the league, they're all going after their own way of getting justice because you didn't get it for the rest of the league and for the rest of the fan base to sit there and say, okay, That's their punishment. We can try and move forward. As upset as we are, we don't need to go further with this. But because it is the way it is, and they get off blanket and almost scot-free in a sense, other than their legacy being tarnished, yeah, there's no punishment. So yeah, you're gonna have players trying to take things in their own hands.
That's exactly what someone just said. 509 says, if the commissioner took away the trophy and the rings, I don't think they'd be headhunting for the Astros.
Not nearly as much. You might get some, but not nearly to what you're gonna get this season.
Oh, that's
I think that's
you
part
think
of
the
it.
Reason why they're being thrown at.
Well, because I
is
feel
because
like people
the commissioner didn't do anything.
Well, I think people feel like it needs to be like the people's court. Like there wasn't any real punishment. And honestly, I would have been fine with them not stripping the title had they gone on some kind of apology tour, because it's hard to apologize, to do it well, to actually apologize and mean it and say it with sincerity, knowing that someone else might not accept your apology and they're just going to be mad at you and that's uncomfortable, is really hard to do. And I feel like we devalue it too often, and so we don't realize how hard it is to do. And they didn't do it, and they didn't do a good job. Then Rob Manfred backed that up by saying, no, I'm not going to take away this, quote, piece of metal. I don't know what that really does to hold them accountable.
That was just marginalizing in a very sort of glib way.
Well, and it was an oversight, a bad oversight. He shouldn't have said it. It doesn't mean he's, like, incapable of doing his job, but it is something that had he put a little bit of thought into. I think what he's trying to say is, look, I don't know what this really accomplishes. I'm hesitating to see what it really does. And people, obviously, there's no right thing to say right now because people are so mad. But because they didn't have that taken away and didn't seem sincere about their apology, people are thinking like, well, got to take it into our own hands.
Baseball needs a good story.
You know what? I think they should go on Judge Judy.
And sort it out there.
I'm just saying, I love Judge Judy. I feel like that would be an amazing, amazing episode. If you have like Jose Altuve,
isn't she
George
the highest
Springer.
Paid woman on TV?
Yes.
Rightfully so.
She is insanely. I mean, she's got like
that's what
a
I'm
couple
saying.
Of yachts.
I would vote.
It's incredible.
I would vote for Judge Judy to ultimately decide whether or not the title should be stripped. Or to just kind of, you know, because what also happens is she gets a little personal with it. She'll be like, shame on you. Shame on you for doing that. Think about what you did. Why would you do that?
I like when the judge goes personal.
Me too.
Jake, you have this issue with the nickel corner spot. You got a little emotional at the top of the hour. I'm sorry about that.
I'm sorry that you were very emotional.
Yeah, you were pounding the floor.
You guys
Micah.
Should have seen him before he came on the show. He's gotten really mad about this before, and he pretends he doesn't get mad because he tries to pretend that it's just like, no, it's just a fact. I'm just saying how it is. And it's like, no, Jake, you're getting really mad about something some people don't care
so
about.
Okay, so my face gets a little red when I'm talking about it. It's not
that's
a big
not
deal.
It. You also got to like hit the table.
All right, let me ask you this question straight up. What was their defense, overall defense rated last year? Like 22nd?
26, 27.
Okay, 27. If they were in nickel more, like 50% more of the time, what do you think that changes?
Well, if they were in nickel defense 50% more of the time,
I'm asking a question right now specifically about scheme versus talent.
Right.
I don't know that it would have changed a lot, Jake. Maybe you disagree with me because I think part of the problem started before the start of the season when you had to let Justin, not had to, but you opted to let Justin Coleman walk in free agency because you weren't willing to pay him. And that was a tough decision you had to make because you had so many other deals to make that it's just, look, we can't pay everyone we want to pay, but maybe didn't realize at the time that you couldn't find a replacement you were totally happy with.
I think what ends up happening is you had a situation where you had lost identity. You were not who you always been, in a sense. And I also believe that had they played nickel defense, let's say 50% of the time, I still think that pass rush ultimately was really, really bad. And they opted to play more soft zone. If they had played nickel coverage, I think they play more man-to-man principles, which helps shrink the windows down a little bit for opposing offenses, which makes things inherently more difficult.
But you didn't
so
think
it
that
helps
that
was, it helps out the pass, it helps out the secondary, it helps out the pass rush a little bit. I think that they would be a little bit better, but they just simply didn't have enough talent on that defensive line for them to make a massive jump. I don't think they go to middle of the pack by playing nickel defense. Basically what you're asking me, do they make that big of a jump from 27 to 15 or 14 or something
but
like
the,
that?
The more important question there is, would they be improved to the point where maybe they could have gotten by the Packers.
Potentially.
Who were throwing to Devontae Adams like every down and burning him.
Potentially, yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what we're really talking about.
I think they could have put them in a better position, and I guarantee you it would have put them in a much better position here in 2020, because now you're not having to sit here and wonder about Ugo Amadi and can he do it, can he not, can he be your starter of the future. You would already have that answer right now, whether you need to be looking for the next nickel corner or if he's your guy of the future.
We are losing a local legend pretty soon, but there is some good news surrounding that. We're going to talk about it next on 710 ESPN Seattle.
This is The Timeline
with Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
I like it. Feeling it.
I didn't realize
timeline
that.
Let's go.
I actually even like it even more because I just found out that there's a little cowbell to start it off.
I need more cowbell.
Yeah, we need a little bit more. Howdy, could you get some more cowbell?
Can you get more cowbell, please?
Yes, I got the thumbs up. Thank you, sir.
Timeline is where we tell you guys everything that is trending in sports today, biggest trending stories. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at JTHeaps9, at Stacey Rost, at Tom Wassel. Very shameless plug. Let's start with the first story you guys are going to see. So ticket sellers have told Congress that they'd support a federal mandate to disclose all fees up front because people are really, really upset when they go to get tickets to their favorite sporting events or concerts or whatever from Ticketmaster, and you find out only after you've put in your information that you have to pay an additional, like, what, $40?
I'm surprised that ticket brokers or whatever you want to call them support this.
Well, because they probably have no choice, right?
Well, I mean, maybe at the end of the day they won't, but the trick is the hidden fees at the very end of the transaction, right?
Correct.
Like you're buying tickets for a concert or a Seahawks game or whatever. You go online, you put in all your credit card information. Then at the end, it gives you a subtotal plus all the fees.
Right.
And by that time, you're like, oh, well, I've already entered my information. I really want to go. I'll just do it. But if I knew the fees up front, maybe I wouldn't.
Absolutely right. And maybe you wouldn't. You feel like you're getting a pretty good deal on some mid-level seats, and then you go to pay for it, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
So, and then you're like, you know what? This is just how it is. It's how, you know, I can't avoid the situation. So
you just go with it.
Let's go with it. But, yeah, this is going to be a tough day for ticket sellers.
They seem to support it, though.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I think it's nice that they're supporting it, but I wouldn't be shocked if they didn't.
Oh, they are not the good guys.
No, I know.
They're not your friends.
I like this story. Left-handed pitcher Sean Doolittle was told by Nationals Director of Mental Conditioning that he should put lavender oil on the laces of his glove during the 2019 postseason, I think to calm him down. You know, lavender oil, it's very calming. You smell it. And it's a relaxing kind of aroma.
So let me ask you this. Do you like this better than Trevor Moad telling Russell Wilson to not listen to country music?
Do you think Russell Wilson should put on maybe like his towel or maybe even on the laces of the football lavender oil?
Well, hold on a minute. Those are two different questions. Are you asking me if lavender oil on the glove is a more productive idea than the absence of country music?
Yeah, yes. It's a better strategy.
Whew. I don't know that either one is particularly effective.
No, you don't think so?
Well, was the lavender oil to relax him because he was stressed out?
I think so. I'm assuming that's what it is. I mean, it's the director of mental conditioning, so it's trying to find all the ways that you can, like...
Man, I got to tell you, all that flower aromatherapy, I think it's just bunk.
What? No,
lavender... None of that stuff works.
No, lavender is a relaxing thing. Doesn't everyone know that?
No, not if you're super stressed out like I am.
You mean if you're on the mound in the postseason and like the World Series is on the line, and you're like,
if you're always wound up, it doesn't really matter.
It's not going to do anything.
Some flowers are going to help me unwind.
You say that now, but you don't know that. Have you ever been in a situation where you were really stressed and you think when you were yelling at your neighbor, you got in that fight? If you had some lavender oil, I guarantee you, you wouldn't
have
started yelling.
You just whip that bad boy out and then you just take a sniff, a deep breath.
There's nothing any flower is going to do to help me in that situation, or if I'm having a true anxiety attack.
It's so much more than a flower.
You better hit me with the heavy stuff.
Smelling salts?
I mean, Tom, This could be life-changing. We just found something.
I just think you should consider it.
You definitely should consider it.
Nope.
Okay, some local news before I get to my favorite story of the day. Steve Rabel, we all know and love, regular on the huddle during the Seahawks season, will retire from Cairo 7, but he'll stay on as voice of the Seahawks.
By the way, one Steve Rabel will be on with Bob David Moore coming up today at 4:30.
Absolute legend. Yep. We have him on in the huddle. He is such a... I mean, when you talk about the total pro, that's what Steve Rabel is. He is one of the nicest, kindest people you will ever come across, a total pro in every sense of the word. Just truly one of those great Seahawk legends, and I'm really glad that, you know, I'm happy for him and Sharon that they're going to be able to enjoy this time off for him, you know, in this retirement phase of being away from the TV, you know, newscasts.
But he is still... Yes. Doing the Seahawk games. Let's be very clear about that.
Very importantly, he will still be doing the Seahawks, you know, play-by-play broadcast. We have to be some sort of selfish. Like, we can't just lose the GOAT. We can't lose the greatest of all time at this profession.
Do you think he'll still do the huddle with us?
I don't see why he wouldn't. I mean, I would think that would be the priority.
Yeah, I mean, we would obviously convince him.
That's why he's stepping back from Cairo 7.
To focus more on the huddle.
Yeah, more time to his 10 minutes every Thursday.
I don't understand the question. He loves us.
I don't even think he has a choice in this
matter.
What? He doesn't have a choice.
He
we're
told us,
him do
hey,
it.
I'm thinking of, and we were like, nope.
I want you guys to think about something for a second.
Yeah.
Steve Rabel is not just the voice of the Seahawks. He's a city icon, a community icon. Have you ever thought about the type of responsibility that goes with being that type of person? Like, he is, like you said, he is the consummate professional in every sense of the word, but like, he has to present himself a certain way all the time.
Yeah,
he has to dress a certain way. He treats people obviously with respect, and that's who he is, which is why he has found himself in this role. But that is a lot of responsibility when you are viewed so much as a public figure, somebody that people look up
to. That's why I could never be famous. Because one of these days, I'm going to go and I'm going to accidentally, without thinking too much about it, maybe I'll say something rude, you know, or be a little short because I'm in a bad mood or in a hurry. And then all day I'm going to be thinking to myself, oh my gosh, they saw me in my worst mood and now they think I'm horrible.
Well, I got news for you. You are famous.
I am incredibly famous. I'm probably the most famous person of the three of us.
So
at
you
least.
Feel really bad about the way you treated your Starbucks barista.
We don't need to talk about it. Next story of the day, Jungle Cruise capsized at Disney's Magic Kingdom. The ride was on hold for a 105-minute delay, and now it's back up again.
So wait a minute. The Jungle Cruise, everybody know what the Jungle Cruise is in Disney World?
Well, I actually didn't know about it because I've never been to Disney World or Disneyland or whatever it is.
They pile about 10 people in this boat that's on a track, and you go cruising through what's supposed to be like the Amazon.
And according to Jake, it's filled with very live alligators.
No. Yeah, well, when I went on it, I was like, give me a break. I was like 4 at the time or something like that. Like,
no.
It was very real to me at the moment. Mm. Then when I went on it again, when I was a little bit older and wiser, I realized that they were fake. Okay?
Did you think the mouse at Chuck E. Cheese was a real mouse?
I don't want to get into it, but yeah, I was scared of them at one point in time in my life when I was very young.
I think Jake just thought all mascots and animated. Did you ever go to the Rainforest Cafe?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Do you think all of those were real?
No. I did have this Sasquatch one time steal my shoe during a game, and he chucked it into the fans.
Oh, that's
funny. I got really upset. The mascot
the
for the Sonics.
Oh.
Yeah.
He threw your shoe?
Yeah, he took
my shoe
off.
So you have beef with mascots. This explains your anger over Blitz jumping into the mentions, wanting to officiate Curtis's wedding. It's not just because you want to officiate Curtis's wedding. It's because you have issues with mascots.
No, Blitz and I are very, very close friends. Okay, we're very close.
Even though he doesn't say too much.
Yeah, it's hard to communicate at times, but he's a close friend of mine. But just back off, Blitz, okay?
My fiance is a fear of mascots, too, so.
Well, there we go.
So
you hear that, Blitz? You hear that?
Oh, but no personal problems. You hear that, Blitz?
Is everybody on the Jungle Cruise okay, by the way?
Everyone got off fine. Can you imagine if we would have been joking about it forever and then no, everyone's fine.
Yeah.
Everyone's okay. It's
only about
5 feet of water.
Well, 5 feet is not nothing.
It's not nothing, but
if
everyone's
you have kids
okay.
on board,
yeah, everyone's fine.
5 feet of water and I'm riding with Jackson Bodie. Like, I got to hold them above
fine.
Water here.
All right. Our own 5-footer, Danny O'Neill, joins us next. 710 ESPN Seattle.